For your Emmy Awards consideration, ABC's number one comedy, The Conners, starring John Goodman, Laurie Metcalf, Sarah Gilbert, and Lacey Goranson, about the iconic working-class family who face life with love, humor, and perseverance. The Los Angeles Times describes The Conners as finding laughter and light in the darkness, and Decider writes that the show is what a great sitcom looks like. The Conners, eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series and in all eligible categories. Television Academy members can view full episodes at abcfyc.com. From Variety, celebrating 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit Podcast. Emmy-winning Pose star Billy Porter is still taking stock of what the series has meant to him.
I think what Pose has done is bring to light the unprocessed grief and trauma of an entire generation of people. I knew I had grief and trauma. I didn't know that I was in the middle of grieving and still in the middle of it. So ultimately, Pose has been very healing for me.
I'm Michael Schneider, and on this edition of the Variety Award Circuit Podcast, we talk to Billy Porter about the emotional finale to FX's Pose and what this show has meant to him, its viewers, and to the communities in which it provided a voice. Later on, we chat with Breeders stars Martin Freeman and Daisy Haggard about how their show may be the most realistic portrayal of parenthood on TV ever. But first, on the Variety Award Circuit Roundtable, we discuss the increasingly unpredictable limited and anthology series race. It's all next on Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. Stay close. Back to the round table we go. I'm Michael Schneider from Variety, joined as always by Danielle Terciano and Jazz Tankay. And look who we have this week who stopped by. I need a sound effect like a ding dong, like at the door. It's Caroline Framke.
Hello.
Caroline, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, timing is everything. And of course, part of the reason why I wanted you on this week was you killed it with the Pride issue of Variety this year. Two stories, the cover story and the B feature, which was incredible. So a little,
thank you so much,
applause, for pulling that off. But, sort of what were for you, any highlights, to your experience in both these stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think it says a lot that, you know, I was slated to do the cover story with Jazz Jennings and Josie Tota, who ended up being our B feature, was actually just at first a secondary source for the Jazz cover. And then, you know, talking to Josie, which I think Danielle has done too for Saved by the Bell in the past, she's such a fun interview. She's really engaging, so smart. And I was just like, if we don't have another feature, then we should just break this out and give her the spotlight, because I think she's going to be someone that we're going to see in comedy for a long time. So that was really fun and unexpected. A lot of work, sure, but definitely I wouldn't have done that if I didn't feel strongly that she should be given that sort of highlight. And I think it was a really fun interview.
Absolutely. And that was cool. And good timing too, like you mentioned, with Saved by the Bell, which I will confess, I haven't had time to really catch up on this, this new reimagination, what do you call it, Danielle? Is it a revival? Is it a reboot? Is it a remake? Is it a continuation? What are you calling it?
They're calling it a reimagining. I'm calling it a continuation because, you know, the original characters are back. So their lives they've gone on for years off camera and they're back now as adults. So really it's just the world went on without us. And now we're stepping back into it. So reimagining feels a little strong to me, but, you know, it's better than reboot, which is just straight wrong.
I know you hate that word reboot.
I hate when people use it wrong. Yeah, that's all. Yeah. Like, words have meaning. Our jobs as writers should still matter. That's all it is. It's just my very old lady bitterness coming out.
Well, no, this is good for all of our listeners right now. Let's set it up. Let's once and for all, let's clarify, according to Danielle Terciano, what is a reboot?
According to the dictionary, reboots are when you take the existing premise of a show and you do it in a new version, new characters, new actors. So technically revivals would be taking the original premise, reviving it with the same group of people. But because we're now so many years later, it feels unfair to call something like Saved by the Bell a revival, because it is, you know, it's not centered on Zach Morris. We're not in his high school years anymore. We're in his son's high school years. So that's why I say continuation with that, because it literally is just, again, like, we stepped away and then we stepped back. The world has gone on.
And then a remake, of course, is taking the source material and basically adhering to that source material, but just doing a fresh take on it. But it's still that original. So the three R's: live them, learn them, love them.
And then never use them again, because nobody wants to be wrong. So we'll just come up with all new ways of saying it.
There you go. Explained by Danielle. It's just what our listeners needed.
Yeah, right. I know they're all turning off right now. Let's maybe talk about something more fun.
Okay. I think that's fun, by the way. See, Caroline, we go all over the place here. But since we have you, one of the things that we do...
These are the semantics I'm here for.
I was like, yeah, school lessons with Variety staffers.
Hey, you know, this is what do you call it? This is your TED Talk, so... So Caroline, what we've been doing with our guests each week is sort of seeing what their sort of picks for Emmy consideration are. Maybe perhaps a little under the radar that you're hoping Emmy voters pay attention to and give some love as we enter the voting window starting shortly for phase one.
Yeah, I think this year is going to be pretty interesting. It seems like, from what I can tell, there are a bunch of things that people think are definitely going to get nominated, and but a lot of them weren't nominated, haven't been nominated because a lot of things weren't eligible. So I don't know. I'm really interested to see what happens. But for under the radar stuff, I'll go with comedy. I feel like I wish that more people were watching Peacock and that Girls 5 Eva was as big as it should be, because that's such a great show with so many amazing performances. Any one of them would be worthwhile, but Renee Elise Goldsberry and Paula Pell are unbeatable. Another show that came out, I mean, last fall, but I feel like could get something. It has gotten writing nods before, so maybe, you know, the people who are voting are more likely to give it a nod than people think, is Pen 15, which I think had an incredible second season. I didn't think I could like it more than the first season, and then season two just leveled up in a way I was really impressed by. So I'm looking at I tend to get more invested in the comedy stuff just because comedy tends to be where my heart lies. But yeah, those are just a couple of them.
Yeah, no, I agree. And actually, Danielle, in one of your recent issues, you had a dissection of the dueling theater gangs in Pen 15, which was
That scene is so good. I was so happy to see that.
A making a scene feature. Yeah, that was, so it was in the penultimate episode of this first half of season two, the episode called Play. And it's just that moment of like sheer escalation as everybody is more tense as the rehearsal period goes on for their play. And it just... it felt so niche to me when I first watched it, because it felt so much like my theater experience. But then I said, well, how many of us, especially in this business, had that experience? Because we were those kids. So I was like, I know there are people out there that maybe wanted to talk about this and didn't have anyone to talk about it with or whatever. But I was like, I'm going to make the people who made it talk to me about it. So, you know, Maya, Sam, the director, Grace, the production designer, Melissa, the costume designer. I was like, I have so many questions. We couldn't get them all in the actual feature. But that show this season just took it to a new level. As you said, Caroline, that was very surprising to me, but also just really fun.
Yeah, the other thing this season that sort of took me back to a kid was the moment where suddenly there's the third wheel, like the girl who kind of just like weaseled her way into their friendship and suddenly was like, why is she always here? And hey, it's cool that we have a new friend, but she is really, like she's everywhere and starting to cause some real friction. And it's just that awkwardness. And that's sort of the hallmark of this show. And I love how real that feels, because suddenly, like, I break out in sweat sometimes watching that show, reminding me of like when things like that happen and not knowing how to deal with it. And the, you know, just the sheer like panic of being a kid and like handling things like that.
Yeah. The one I haven't rewatched yet from season two is the sleepover episode because it's a horror movie. It's so, so hard to watch. And I just remember the sheer terror of being at a sleepover where things feel like it's going sideways and maybe you're the odd one out, but maybe you're not. That one I can't rewatch, but all the other ones.
That was triggering, that flat that sleepover episode, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, that was triggering because, like, I was that odd person out. Like, it wasn't even a question of, like, am I the odd? You know, you're the odd person out. But maybe that's diving too deep into me. Let's get back to the topics at hand. Girls, so you mentioned Girls 5 Eva isn't really, like, maybe making the waves that you thought it would. That's why it's in this era of not having ratings, it's so hard to tell, right? Because at least in our circles, I feel like we're talking about Girls 5 Eva all the time. We spoke to the stars, which will be an upcoming episode of Award Circuit podcast. So the songs are constantly in my head. In my mind, at least, this thing is a massive hit, but that's not in everyone's mind, clearly. So it is sort of tough to gauge the success of a show like that, especially on a platform like Peacock that, you know, still is finding its footing and not a lot of people even know exists.
Yeah, I was thinking about it because I wrote something for Danielle, actually, a column about Peacock and how I've noticed that its best shows, its buzziest shows are all comedies with focused on around women, girls, in a way where I was really excited to see it. You know, with Girls 5 Eva, you have all these, as Renee Elise Goldsberry's character says, 40 blah blah women who are reuniting. And with something like Rutherford Falls, you have a show run by a Native American woman featuring a lot of Native American women. Where are Lady Parts, which just came out about a young Muslim girl band. God, where are the others? There are so many. Oh, Saved by the Bell, too. So that's been really interesting to see. And it's also been kind of frustrating because I feel like there are all these great shows on Peacock highlighting women you don't usually see. Also, the Amber Ruffin show. You know, she's a very different kind of late night host. And then the NBC schedule coming out in the fall, there are no comedies on it. I'm like, they're all on Peacock. What are we doing? So I don't know how many people are watching Peacock. And I get frustrated with it sometimes. The interface is super annoying. But I've been interested to kind of just see the divide between what ends up on NBC, what's ending up on Peacock, what's the brand. But there are good comedies there.
I think what's interesting is what you said, Mike, of like, you know, our circle, everybody I know is like talking about Girls 5 Eva. I know a lot of people, you know, who write, you know, who are critics, who have blogs, who watch Rutherford Falls. But like outside of that, without having, like, I don't think Peacock has done an event yet for either Rutherford Falls or Girls 5 Eva for the TV Academy. So it's like really difficult to gauge like who's watching the show outside of us lot.
Yeah, Twitter is not real life is a terrible lesson I learn every day. My gauge is always, have my parents heard of the show? Usually the answer is no.
I was going to say, I can't play that game. My father still has antenna TV. TV. Like, he watches reruns of Frasier at 2 a.m. because that's all that he can watch because there's only one channel that still comes in clear. So,
to be fair, that's a perfect 2 a.m. show.
Isn't that also? I feel like that's also on Peacock. We could just put him on Peacock.
But I also, like, where do people post about their shows now? Like, is it Twitter? Is it Instagram? I know it's not on Facebook anymore. Right. Or
I mean, people are still live tweeting, you know, I mean, I've seen, especially like Pose, they just had their series finale and they were, Cass and Steven were live tweeting the finale. So I've seen some of that. I know like the CW shows, the Warner Media shows are still very heavy into, you can engage with your fans that way when it's quote unquote live, if you have, you know, a traditionally airing show. So Twitter's still around, you know. But I think it's like, I feel like it's a different conversation on Instagram because it's not as thread heavy. I don't feel like people dive into the comments on Instagram the way that they do. And maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But I mean, I see a lot of people on Instagram just posting like, you know, the key art of whatever and being like, I love this new show, you know, who's watching this new show or whatever. But it's harder, I think, to get engagement that way.
And also it's about it's hard to live tweet a streaming show that drops all at once because people are watching it at different rates. Like, I definitely feel like something like Bridgerton would have, the reaction would have been much different. Not that fewer people watched or anything, but I think it would have been really interesting to see what would have happened if that had aired like a linear Shonda Rhimes show. Or, well, I know we're going to talk about limited series perhaps today. And something I wrote in my review that I was really frustrated by is that Amazon dropped all of the Underground Railroad at once, which I think was a mistake, even though I know they wanted to get in by the Emmy deadline. But that's such a dense show. And I think people needed time to sort of absorb and react. And, you know, people are talking about it, certainly, but everyone's at a different stage. There's no real time to talk about a single episode. And each of those episodes is so intense on its own that, I don't know, I wonder how that also affects all of this.
Yeah, compared to, and look at this segue, perfect segue, thank you, Caroline, right into limited series. And when you look at Mayor of Easttown and just the conversation we're still having about that show and so fueled by that week-to-week drop where people were talking about it for weeks on end, and I'm sure that's had an impact. I mean, it's definitely now, you know, a contender and in the running for a limited series, a show that, you know, we, you know, weren't even talking about a month ago, now is there. So that is the power of that week to week. And so that's perhaps pushed out some other possible contenders. So limited series is, you know, a few months ago, we said it was a sure thing for Queen's Gambit. Maybe it still is.
I don't believe that I said it was a sure thing. I just want to go back and be like, excuse me. It's definitely, I feel like, still a front runner for a nomination. I remember very pointedly being like, Clayton, it's too early to call it for the win. Even, you know, he's writing predictions for the website. He's writing predictions for the Emmy Extra Editions. And in a few of those, he's already kind of said, you know, this one is likely to take the trophy in September. This one could play spoiler in September. And I'm like, man, you are brave. Because we are still, our nomination round ballot isn't, you know, it's still happening. So that is brave. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you got to go for it. That's why we love Clayton. But so what do we think now is the chief sort of spoiler for Queen's Gambit in that category? Is it I May Destroy You, which I kind of feel like is starting to get a little bit of a second wind?
I think Mare is definitely going to keep its momentum. Like, it came in at the right time. I think, like you said, a month ago, like, Kate Winslet was like on the border of a nomination. Now I think she's almost guaranteed to get one. I think I May Destroy You has got a lot of buzz. I think WandaVision will stay in. My concern with Underground Railroad, like Caroline said, is like they dropped all 10 episodes at once. And Danielle and I spoke about it ages ago, but like I was watching three episodes at a time and I actually said it to Barry Jenkins. I said, I haven't seen all 10 yet. I'm just taking them in. And he said, that's the best way to consume it. So when people are saying, like posting online, they're watching it, I'm like, just watch two episodes at a time. Don't watch it all in one go because you miss. And it's so deep. But I think that could get in, which might get in and Small Axe might not. I don't know. It is just like a bloodbath out there. And what about The Undoing? You know, that was so popular.
Well, until that ending, right? That probably did it in, perhaps.
I think, yeah, I feel like now, because it's so long ago, it didn't clean up. It didn't get any. I mean, it got noms at Winter Awards, but it wasn't, you know, the exception of Donald Sutherland, it wasn't like a big winner. I feel like Small Axe and Underground are both bigger contenders for noms. Like in the sense of, if, you know, there are fewer slots there. If there were 8 slots for limited series the way there are for drama and comedy, I think, yeah, of course, Undoing is getting one of those 8. But with 5, I don't know. It feels like, and you know, it's funny, it feels like things that aired so long ago, like the battle that they have now is just, how visible are you during these FYC seasons, right? Like, do people even remember when you aired? Because we talk about this all the time, you know, with the just sheer volume of stuff coming for us as professionals who can spend an entire day watching TV because it's part of our job, it still can feel overwhelming. But all of these voters have actual day jobs. And then they go home and they have to watch these shows to vote on them. And I you know, I see people talking about Underground Railroad, and I'm glad they're watching it. I'm glad they're taking their time with it. But I worry that if you don't get to like episode 7, 8, and you vote before you finish it, you may not vote for it. And you may not have even seen some of the actors. You know, some of the actors are not in the first few episodes that are in contention for supporting roles. And so it's just like, well, how can you make an informed decision if you haven't actually seen this whole thing? But where are you going to have the time to see this whole thing? You know, I hate to use the word scary because like it's just TV, but it's scary. It's like, voting matters, man. Okay. We saw what's happened in elections and whatever, it matters.
Yeah. That was the danger of dropping Underground Railroad so late in the eligibility season. I think you're right. And people are so overwhelmed now that I don't know if they're going to get all the way through, because you're right. It is a tough watch. You need to pace yourself, but we're running out of time.
Yeah. I do think if there's one show that aired a while ago that I don't think will be hurt by that, it's I May Destroy You. I think that still has buzz. Michaela Cole just won the BAFTA TV award. She's been super visible. She's, when she gives an interview, it's always smart and interesting. And not for nothing, I think the Emmys might want to correct the sins of the Golden Globes snubbing it completely. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Emmys were like in your face a little bit to give it something. So if I was to bet on anything winning this category, which like Danielle said, it's extremely early and this is a wild thing to do, but I would be surprised if it's not I May Destroy You at this point.
I will credit the Variety cover if that happens.
I mean, that's a huge boost of visibility. It is. Like, let's just be honest, you know? I mean, she isn't doing a ton of press for Emmys, but that effectively ends up as Emmy press because it's in the right window.
Yeah, and it was a fire cover. It was amazing.
That was one of the best ones we've ever done. It was wild.
That show debuted June 7, 2020. I mean, that's a whole year
ago. But we're still talking about it.
Yeah.
I mean, and people are talking about it, you know, other contenders are picking it as we run a contenders picks every year in one of our last Emmy sections in our issue. And we talk to showrunners and actors about what they're voting for. And, you know, spoiler alert, a lot of them are saying, I hope this show, I May Destroy You, gets nominated. You know, it, literally what you just said, Caroline, we had some people be like, it's a sin if it doesn't, you know, like it's just...
Wait, it's a sin? That's a different show.
I realized after I said it that you were going to say that. I was like, I shouldn't have worded it that way. But I mean, yeah, we've had a lot of people just, you know, say exactly what we were saying. It got snubbed before, and you know, pay attention to it. Sometimes hearing the snub makes you pay attention to it more because everyone's upset about something, and who doesn't love to complain?
This is true. But you look at down the list and a lot of huge franchises that I don't think, at least in the limited series category, I mean, a lot of the acting categories perhaps, but some of these big names like the Genius franchise, Genius Aretha, Fargo, and you know, others that have been in the mix for a while, like Good Lord Bird, Your Honor, Comey Rule, you know, all huge projects, but it's just a jam-packed category, so you can't have them all.
I have to say HBO's doing a great job though of campaigning their shows, and you know, they've got they've got an incredible slate, and they're doing they're giving each child equal treatment. Like, I don't feel they're not. Some networks don't always succeed at doing it. HBO is doing a stellar job of it.
Yeah, for HBO and HBO Max, which, you know, is going to potentially come on strong with both Flight Attendant and Hacks. So should be an interesting year for some of the newer streaming services as well. Real quick around the horn, anything new that y'all have watched? Not necessarily Emmy related, but just anything that's caught your fancy in the past week or two. Jazz?
I saw Fast 9 last night. It is the 9th, 10th installment in that franchise. And I have to say, it is so much fun. They embrace the silly of it, but it's a great action film with lots of big action sequences and really, really just enjoyable. And then in
real quick, Canworthy apparently. So we ever thought we'd
exactly,
see the day where they'd be
going to Cannes.
Yeah, screening F9, the Fast and Furious at Cannes, but okay.
You know, it's a blockbuster. It's what do you expect? You know, if you want an Oscar film, wait till September or whatever. But it's good fun, and it's good to see them all, you know, racing around going to... Helen Mirren is stellar. She is such an incredible actress. And then I saw In the Heights in IMAX too, which is, if you can, go and see it in a movie theater. If you don't have the anxiety, go see it, because it is the perfect cure to everything that we've been through. And it's amazing. And Anthony Ramos is amazing. He's also in treatment too. So, yeah. Loved it.
Excellent. Excellent. Danielle, how about you?
I mean, I'm only watching summer TV at this point. So I will say Schmigadoon surprised me. Cecily Strong, Keegan-Michael Key for Apple. Like, I don't know the Brigadoon musical. So watching this show, it made me actually go and look up some clips and Google it. And it is bonkers. But it was just one of those shows where I didn't know what to expect. And it really leans into its insanity, which is fun. And then I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this, but, you know, the new Gossip Girl has a really interesting take on the title character / mystery that I won't say anything else about, because I feel like they'll come for me with like their pitchforks. But I was not a huge fan of the original. And so I had a lot of questions / concerns about how self-aware this version would be, given all the conversations we have about wealth and privilege and, you know, should we be pumping up people who have it but don't use it well? And, you know, what is the responsibility when these are teenagers and, like, you know, they're born into this? So do they even understand the level of what they have and whatever? And I think the show does a good job of answering those things.
Cool. And Caroline, what new have you liked?
What new? Well, right now I am watching the new Blindspotting, which is Starz's sort of spinoff of the movie that came out a few years ago. And it's really cool. It's really interesting. They really incorporate a lot of like spoken word and dance and sort of surreal aspects of it. And that now stars Jasmine Cephas-Jones, also from Hamilton, Daveed Diggs' former co-star, and she's great in it. So I am really enjoying that. Also, will shout out the upcoming season of Tuca and Birdie, which has moved from Netflix to Adult Swim, and I believe that's premiering on the 13th. But I'm very, very happy that's coming back for a second season. I was so sad when it was canceled, and I feel like not enough people know that it is coming back. It's just not on Netflix. It's on Adult Swim. So it's on a television. You can find it. And the last thing I will say is that I have caught up on the current season of Top Chef, which is the Portland season that they've been producing, that they produced during the pandemic last summer. And I will say that they have done a really smart job updating that show for the constraints they had to do. Like the Restaurant Wars, I want them to do it like this every year. It's usually such a stressful episode. And this time they did a chef's table just for the judges. That was very intimate, but extremely still high stakes. So I don't know. I thought that was really smart. And for me, it's sometimes fun to watch that stuff because I don't have to review it necessarily. So that's fun.
It's been a great season of Top Chef. So shout out to that. I will end it by mentioning the thing that everyone was talking about this weekend, but it kind of, to me, it lived up to the hype, the Bo Burnham special Inside. The songs are just incredible, and it is such a fascinating watch. So well done, all solo over the past year by Bo Burnham. Apparently, he's releasing the album of this music on Thursday. So today, as you're listening to this, I will be running out and to grabbing it or streaming it. So good, so well done. And now an Emmy contender because they dropped it on May 30th. So look at that. They got it under the wire. And so who knows? We might be talking about Bo Burnham Emmy winner as well coming up. So thank you so much, Caroline, for stopping by.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, definitely. And Danielle and Jazz, we'll see you next week. It's Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. I'm Michael Schneider. Billy Porter's Pray Tell on FX's Pose was a beacon of light and love for his friends and chosen family within the ballroom community. The character also helped the actor break historical ground when Porter won the Lead Drama Actor Emmy in 2019 for the first season of the period piece. He became only the fifth Black actor and the first openly gay actor to take that trophy. But unfortunately, all good things must come to an end, and Pose signed off with a shortened third season.
I want to be remembered as a representation of all that the Balls could be. Hope and joy and family. We deserve to have our dreams fulfilled. Let's give these children a show they will never forget.
All right, it's time for a spoiler alert here. If you haven't watched the Pose finale yet, then stop right here. Go watch it and then come back, okay? All right, you back? All right, let's jump in. Porter's character, ballroom MC and father figure Pray Tell, had quite the journey in the final season, returning to his hometown to make peace with his family and revisit his first love, restarting things with love interest Ricky, and getting into a clinical trial for a new AIDS drug. But when Ricky revealed his own health was deteriorating, Pray Tell pretended he had extra meds, but really just gave Ricky his own. This sacrifice resulted in Pray Tell passing away. See, I told you this was a spoiler alert. Variety's Danielle Terciano checked in with Porter to discuss that emotional final episode and what it was like to film the last season of Pose during the pandemic. They began by discussing when and how he found out about Pray Tell's fate.
I knew in season one that ultimately Pray Tell wasn't going to make it in Blanca Wood.
Wow. Okay.
They had a real understanding about where they wanted the show to go early on. So I knew that ultimately, however long the series went, at the end, I would not be making it. You know, I'm 51 years old. I lived through the AIDS crisis. I was there. The trauma is real. The grief is real. I think what Pose has done is bring to light the unprocessed grief and trauma of an entire generation of people. I knew I had grief and trauma. I didn't know that I was in the middle of grieving and still in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So ultimately, Pose has been very healing for me. There's a lot of survivor's guilt that comes along with many things, with surviving the plague, with surviving the hood. You know, there's a lot of like guilt, survivor's guilt that does nobody any good that must be addressed. And I don't know, this, you know, Pose, it really just made me have to really just look at all of it and really sort of ask myself, do you want to heal and tell a different story? Or do you want to be in the same quagmire of shame for the rest of your life? Shame and pain and trauma and all of that for the rest of your life. Do you? Yeah. It's like, it's not fun, actually. So I'm tired. I've spent the better part of half a century not dealing with my trauma, not working towards healing in a real way. You know, it's real now. As a result of the beautiful experience that Pose has been.
I mean, what does that look like? Is working on the show, doing some of those scenes, was that helpful for the healing process, to start the healing process? Or is it really a conversation, a journey that you had to start once the show was over for you?
Honey, I've been in the process of healing since my mid-20s.
Okay.
So, you know, I started going to therapy when I was 25. I've been there ever since. What was different about this year in particular is quarantine And then discovering the difference between regular therapy and then like real targeted therapy. I went into trauma therapy, specifically trauma therapy. You know, there are things to do. There are exercises to engage in. There's a system that is in place, a beautiful, beautifully crafted way to help get to the other side of trauma. And it is not easy. And it takes a lot of work. And it's not fast. It's not quick. It's not, you know, it's not perfect. As a perfectionist, you know, I have a little bit of perfectionism syndrome. You know, all of the things that aren't good, all of the things that you have to face. Like, yep, I gotta face that. Like, I'm a human being. And I'm allowed to be a human being, and it's okay to not be okay. And it's okay to not feel good and not be perfect and not, yeah, it's okay. It's okay to just be exactly where you are. It's okay.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting too that, you know, you were talking about the survivor's guilt that you felt, and the show brings that in. I mean, seeing Ricky, especially knowing what Pray Tell did for Ricky to keep him healthy and keep him alive. Like, the show does start to have that conversation. Was that an area where you got very involved collaboratively, maybe with the writers or the directors, or even Delon to talk about, you know, the portrayal of that?
No, my process in surrounding this show is much, you know, like our writers and our creators, they really are observant, you know, of us and our lives, and they pull from things and they ask us things, but, you know, and they have, you know, implemented some of our own stories, and, you know, you go to work and you play the scene. We didn't have to talk about it a lot because it's what we live every day. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of talking because this is a show where you actually need the real people to tell the story. So they got the real people to tell the story. So we've lived it. We don't have to talk about it. We've actually all lived a version of the stories that we're telling. So I think that's what makes it so authentic. You know, that's what makes it feel so real, is because it is.
Yeah, no, it's so true. I mean, you know, I did not grow up in the ballroom culture. So for me, watching you guys portray that opened my eyes to a new community. But it also, I think, as you just said, I think if it would have been done with people who were not actually a part of the community, I don't think that I would have felt like I was seeing something real in it. Yeah. Understanding what it really is. You know, it's an interesting.
Imagine that.
I know.
Imagine that as storytellers, we're just now getting to the place isn't where that, the people whose story we're telling is at the center of telling.
Exactly. Exactly. Which sounds crazy, but it also sounds crazy to me that, you know, it took so long to even bring a show about ballroom culture and about the AIDS epidemic to television at all. You know, I mean, the fact that this is such a part of so many people's lives.
Yeah, I just, you know, I want to be very clear about my stance on that. It doesn't matter how long it took. We're here now.
Right.
If you're concerned about how long it took, you're not in the present. Mm. And if you're not in the present, then the real story and the real healing can't happen. If I'm mad that I'm just getting here, then I'm not doing the work. Stay present. We're here now. We may have been the first, but we're most definitely not going to be the last. Thank you for bringing that back into our consciousness, Miss Vice President Kamala Harris.
Right.
You know, right. It's like, no, it's not right. Yes, it's bullshit. And we're here now. And let's bring everybody else in the room too. You know, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, yeah. And that honestly, that's the healthy place to be.
Being in the room has given me the power to stay in the room. I'm focused on staying in the room, not worried about that I wasn't here before. I'm focused on staying in the room and bringing everybody I know with me.
Yeah, yeah. So I do want to talk, though. I mean, as you're talking about, you know, being in the room, having everybody with you, I want to talk about some of these final balls. Because, you know, there's some very, I'm going to say tragic. I mean, there's some very sad things that happened this season to your character, you know, even outside of the fact that we lose him, like seeing him struggle with alcoholism in the beginning of the season and seeing, you know, the push and pull of his childhood and is he going to have what he wants when he visits his family. But then we do also have some really beautiful celebratory moments as well. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what that was like filming these final ball scenes, you know, amid COVID, amid like our world is in shambles, but you guys are able to find something to celebrate. How different was it this season? And did you feel like there was more of a need for those moments to kind of pop?
Well, we didn't really get to the balls until the last final week of shooting because of all of the COVID protocols and such. And they were trying to wait as long as possible to see how much we could do. You know, it's not lost on me that the show is about a very specific time in history when the world was in a global epidemic, and now we're sort of going through the same thing collectively. I think it was really smart how the parallels have been drawn this season, because I think what the people need the most is inspiration. What the people need the most is to be reminded that it's only through the collective energy of coming together and leading with love that any of this goes away and that we get to the other side of this. It's only inside of that. We've done it before. Those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it, blah, 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 blah. And yet, here we are again. My goal, my hope, and my prayer is that our show can be a catalyst for real change, you know, from the inside out, personally. You know, we, the people, are the only ones that could change the world. And we have to show up for each other. Across the board, we have to show up for each other. I don't know that that's happening in the way that it should right now. I know there are a lot of people on the planet who are trying. And there are a lot of people on the planet who don't give a fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
So my prayer and my hope is that there are more of us than them. And yes, it is us and them.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do it. I didn't do it.
Right.
But we have to acknowledge what is. We have to be able to name the thing, whatever the thing is, so that we can heal the thing. You know, America don't like that part. America likes to act like things didn't happen. And so then we're stuck. We're stuck in the same shit that we've been in. And none of it is going to change until there's a collective acknowledgement that the thing is the thing. I'm still turning on the news and seeing white people tell black people that there is no systemic racism in America. It's like you.
Yeah.
How can you heal the thing until you recognize that there is a thing?
Yeah. I don't, and that's interesting because I don't know, like, is that, to me, that's a question of like, are they in denial or are they living in a different world?
It doesn't matter
world?
What they, it doesn't matter.
That's crazy.
It doesn't matter. It's a lie. It's wrong. It's not right.
Right.
And this is why we're still here.
Yeah. But you've had three seasons of this show, and you know we talk so much about the impact of the show, you know, in the industry and beyond the industry. So like, yes, we know that these people are here that still are living in archaic mindsets. But I want to hear the flip of that too. I mean, what do you hear from people in terms of, you know, the way the show has inspired them, or the things that the conversations that we've been able to have maybe?
Well, every day. I mean, I've been able to have conversations with my family, even just this weekend, just this past weekend, as a result of Pose and as a result of the fact that, you know, people in my immediate family have been exposed to the life that I lived without them.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, the show depicts that as well, like going into Pray Tell's backstory. I mean, it's a little, maybe a little art imitating life, or the flip.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, if I don't ever say anything else in my life, I will have said it. And I'm already saying a whole lot of other things. It's time for Billy to tell a different story. And I'm getting ready to tell that story. And everybody's going to see it. And everybody's going to hear it. And it's all, you know, it's all joy. It's all love. It's all healing. It's all forward motion. The world only spins forward. That's what I'm living on.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel so blessed and lucky to have lived long enough to see this day and to have been the vessel, to have been chosen to be the vessel to tell this story. You know, it's my story.
Yeah.
It's mine. It is my story. You know, it's my complete story. You know, including the HIV that you will all now know of. You know, you can't speak about this, but May 19th, you know, as of May 19th, the world will know. You know, I've been living with HIV since 2007. And look at me. You know, it's like we manifest what we speak, what we believe. That's what we manifest. Speak life into yourself. It don't matter what anybody else says. Speak life into yourself and keep doing that.
Does that make it more challenging, though, for you, like when you're playing this character who is so close to you, is that harder because you have to go to these darker places?
Not for me.
Okay.
Not for me. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
That's why I'm an artist. That's my calling. That's my purpose. That's my ministry. That's why I'm here. So it's not, I mean, it's difficult to do. You know, it's hard, you know, it's complex. It's not easy,
mm-hmm.
but that's the whole point for me. That's what I, you know, as an artist, that's what I believe I'm here for. You know, art is how civilizations heal. That's what Toni Morrison says. I'm gonna read you my favorite quote. You know, Toni Morrison says, this is precisely the time when artists go to work. There's no time for despair. There's no place for self-pity. There's no need for silence. There's no room for fear. We speak, we write, we do language. That is how civilizations heal. You know, that's all I'm interested in, y'all. If it's not going to heal somebody, if it's not going to do, you know, it's not about me and my own ego. I've had enough of all that, you know, and it's all good. It's great. But like, I'm in this for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
I do this for a reason that's beyond myself and beyond my bank account.
Right.
You know, and beyond my Instagram followers. You know, it's deeper than that for me.
Right. I mean, you seem very like perfectly aligned this show with that message, right? Like not every actor is obviously in that situation where like a lot of actors want to be able to do that, but they don't get the role. They don't get the show
that allows. I'm 51 years old. It just happened 4 years ago.
Right. Right. So,
but I asked for it.
Okay. That was where I was going, was I was going to ask like what you do when
you're
not there.
I've been asking for it for years. I've been asking for it. I've been speaking it into my existence. I've been, you know, putting it on my vision board. I've been writing it in my journal. I've been, you know, all of the stuff that one is supposed to do to bring, to manifest what they want, what a person wants. I'm a living proof of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there was a long time when it wasn't this. There was a long time when it was not this kind of work
right.
for me.
And that's the thing. I mean, this season really gave you a lot, like a lot, obviously, quote, to do, but a lot of the different spectrum of emotions. I mean, I touched on earlier, like he struggles with alcoholism in the beginning, and there's a relationship with Ricky and visiting his family, and like just they pack a lot of story.
And facing death.
And facing death, of course. When you're faced with just such dense scripts of so much material, so much emotional material, where do you even start? How do you break it down? What is your process in terms of getting into the individual pieces? Can you compartmentalize? Can you say, I need to focus on the mindset for this moment, and it's very different for this moment?
This was, you know, you're having an actor process conversation.
I tend to do that. Everyone hates it.
And it's hard to talk about process when in fact the process for me has been living it. I lived it. That was my process.
So is it just accessing your own
all I needed to do was show up with this particular job in this particular instance. It's not like this all the time, but for this particular job in this particular instance, I have lived absolutely every single part of it. You know, one of the protests, or like two of the protests, actually all of the protests from season three, I'm sorry, the season finale. Mm-hmm. You know, I was there. I was already living in New York City when those things were happening. I was either there or I was watched it on the news in real time, or I was, you know, like I was there.
Yeah.
I was there for the whole thing. You know, so it's like that was the gift of it for me, was that a lot of my work was just having lived.
Yeah.
And all I had to do was just access my real life.
But I mean, when you lived it, it was years ago. You didn't have the hindsight you have now when you're telling these stories. Did you notice when you were telling these stories now that we were telling them through a different lens, you related to them differently in any way? And especially, you can correct me if this is not an area where it was true for you, but I'm thinking specifically of things like, you know, getting him into the trial at all, the fact that they're, you know, not really allowing Black or brown people in, you know, that's a conversation that we still are having, but we're having it with more context.
Yeah. I think, yes. I mean, you know, just the context of the antiretroviral drugs, you know, coming out in 96, it's like, you know, Pray Tell didn't make it, but I did. You know, that's the context that we have. You know, so we can speak about life and living. We can speak about choosing life and living because we got to the other side. That's the perspective.
When you think about, you know, the ending of the show, Pray Tell's ending, but then also the ending of the show as a whole, how strongly did you feel that hope needed to be a big part of the message in as you're speaking to choosing life?
If it's not going to be hopeful, there's no reason to do it. That's how I feel as an artist. It's like, if I'm going to take you to the depths of hell, I have to leave you with some hope. That's my aesthetic. That's not everybody's aesthetic. I'm glad that this was our, you know, our creative's aesthetic. I'm glad that it was their aesthetic, you know, because hope is hard when you're in the middle of the mess, when you're in the thick of it. It's hard.
It also feels hard because, like, historically, so many of these stories, they mine the trauma of them. And there's we don't have a lot of opportunity, but we also don't have a lot of reference points to see, as you were talking about, like, the beyond. And so giving this opportunity, it feels like you couldn't have necessarily done it any other way. But I'm curious also, you know, if you feel like there's a level of, we've done the trauma, I don't want to do it anymore, because that's not all we are.
Well, I think I said earlier, it's time to tell a different story. I'm ready to tell a different story. If I never do anything else again in my life, this will have been enough. And now I'm telling a new story, one of healing, one of regeneration, one of life. you know, and that doesn't mean that there's no trauma in it. You know, the Buddha says life is suffering. So when we say yes to that fact, then we suffer less, as opposed to this idea that everything is supposed to be hunky-dory and happy all the time. That's not possible. It's impossible. You know, so receive the knowledge that everybody suffers. Life is suffering. Oh, okay. Then it's a little less. Because I'm expecting it.
Sure, yeah.
As opposed to having some expectation that something's wrong if it's not. Nothing's wrong because you have suffering and trauma. Nothing's wrong.
But you can come through it. Right.
Yes.
Can you, I know it's probably early, but can you speak to, like, when you leave a character like Pray Tell behind, how do you want to take that next step? You said, you know, obviously new stories, but how different do you need your next role to be in order to?
I don't know. You know, it'll come. You know, I got a bunch of stuff that I'm doing. You know, my next role that the world is going to see is the fairy godmother in Cinderella.
Mm-hmm. Which is different. Yeah.
It's a new story, honey.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a brand new story. Like, for real, brand new.
Well, thank you. We're looking forward to seeing that. And thank you for joining us on Award Circuit.
Thank you.
That's Billy Porter, star of Pose. Catch up on the series via FX on Hulu. After the break, Breeders stars Martin Freeman and Daisy Haggard will make you feel okay if you've chosen not to be a parent. From Los Angeles, this is Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. For your Emmy Awards consideration, ABC's number one comedy, The Conners, starring John Goodman, Laurie Metcalf, Sarah Gilbert, and Lacey Goranson, about the iconic working-class family who face life with love, humor, and perseverance. The Los Angeles Times describes The Conners as finding laughter and light in the darkness, and Decider writes that the show is what a great sitcom looks like. The Conners, eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series and in all eligible categories. Television Academy members can view full episodes at abcfyc.com. And we're back. It's the Award Circuit Podcast. I'm Michael Schneider. Time has moved on in season two of the FX comedy series Breeders, the show that explores the parental paradox that you'd happily die for your children, but quite often also want to kill them. Luke, played by Alex Eastwood, is now 13 years old, and Ava, played by Eve Purnell, is 10, serving up brand new parenting challenges for Paul, played by Martin Freeman, and Allie, played by Daisy Haggard. I recently spoke with Freeman and Haggard about the changes in season two and what it's like to now be playing the parents of older kids and the dynamic that comes with it. I began by asking them how parents usually react to the show.
I get people thanking me, actually. Yeah, well, thanking us for the show. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it sort of makes people hopefully feel a little bit less alone or you know, less wrong.
Right.
Or something. Yeah.
Or even maybe feel like they're slightly better parents. Maybe they feel like, oh, maybe I have it a little more under control.
They either be smug or feel recognized, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And if they're feeling smug, I don't believe them anyway.
Right. Yeah.
That was why this show, was why I wanted to make the show. Because... I just didn't believe people. I thought, you know, I thought either people are lying or they're not there. You know, you're either not at home or you're lying. If you are presenting to the world something that's just like purely Little House on the Prairie. And actually, even Little House on the Prairie had their moments.
Yeah. Well, and we live in an age of social media where if you just look at Instagram, you know, everyone's lives look perfect. They have the perfect kids, they have the perfect setup, and sometimes it's hard to remember that. No, they're showing you the best foot, but they're struggling just like you're struggling. So it's...
Yes, I mean, that must be true. That I assume that's true.
So talk a little bit about season two and the decision to make that jump to sort of, you know, go deeper into the marriage, but also showcase the kids as they're entering their preteen and teen years and the stories that come out of it. What was that discussion in sort of making that leap?
The time jump was always going to happen, you know, from when Chris, Simon and I were talking about doing the show and developing the show, that we always wanted to jump up in age between series one and series two. Partly because, you know, there are different interesting things going on in the life of a child and therefore in the household. And also because you can do more with the actors, you know, with the best will in the world, you can only expect to do so much with very small children. I think the actors that we have, the actors we had last year were fantastic, but we've got a great pair this year who are able to sort of rise to that challenge of what they're being asked to do. The challenges that come for the characters are also challenges for the actors, you know, including me and Daisy. Me and Daisy are still trying our best, but this time we were trying our best with people who were a little bit older. That was always the plan.
And Daisy, how did what were your thoughts in sort of how much things were going to change and the focus of these relationships was going to change in season two?
Well, I just really, I really enjoyed the shift, because I have children that are young and the stage before. So for me, I always say that the thing about breeders, it's like acts as the future, the fearful future, my own fearful future. I see what's coming. And so there's a whole other sort of world and wealth of storylines and issues and troubles that you can therefore explore because the kids are that bit older. Just in terms of that, what it's like to have teenagers, which obviously I don't know what that's like yet. I get a glimmer from playing Ali. but then, as Martin said, you have these brilliant kids who can hold their own, more than hold their own on a four-page scene, better than me often, on a four-page scene, showing me up. And so you get to really kind of dig in and play juicy scenes with them. Because they can learn four pages quite fast because their brains are so clever.
Are you prepared now for those teenage years, or are you terrified now for those teenage years?
I'm terrified because I'm sort of, 3 and 6 year old. It's a scrabble. I have a 3 year old that sleeps on my face, it's all full on and crazy. But when I think about these grown up problems, I think, oh gosh, that's when it's a whole other phase of parenting, isn't it? And it's terrifying.
No, it's a reminder when you do have those young kids and you think, oh, it gets better. Some ways it does. Some ways it's much more difficult. And the issues that you have to deal with the kids. Talk a little bit about that in the issues that the kids face, like anxiety, what were sort of the thoughts in bringing a deeper, more complicated storyline to parenting in season two?
Well, I think it was the complication or the complexity of it, I suppose, that we were embracing rather than thinking of it as issues led or issues based. I mean, obviously there is a lot of talk at the moment about mental health issues and quite rightly so, but I think because we had always decided to shove it forward a few years, and because Luke as a character had displayed some anxiety in series one, I guess it was logical that, either it had all magically gone away or that it might have developed and to a certain extent solidified by the time he was 12, 13. And it's all, in a sort of ruthless, dramatic writer's way, I suppose, or comedic writer's way, it's all grist to the mill,
Yes.
It's all stuff that you can be used to either dramatic or comic effect. So Luke has anxiety and Ava also, she has her own little dalliance as well. Well, I can say it to you because everyone in America has seen it. Not everyone in America has seen it. If only that were true. But the people, it's been out. So yeah, she takes a little left turn at religion as well. So those are things that neither of which are a problem as far as I'm concerned. But as far as Paul and Ali are concerned, Ava's dalliance with religion has come out of nowhere and is surprising, let's just say that. And Paul particularly, I suppose, takes it upon himself to try and understand what that's about, because he takes it as, I want her to be my best mate. And if we were best mates, she would have told me about that. And she's been hiding it because of Paul's alleged, but also quite true temper. And she thought he'd go mad, but, you know, she suddenly found Jesus, actually. She discovered that, no, actually what upset him was that she didn't think she could confide in him. They've both got these, it's called being alive, isn't it? It's not even issues. It's, yeah. You know, yeah. It's just called life. Yeah. Stuff
happens. Complications of life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and that's like you said, it's a great gist for the mill, and you could, you know, do these stories for forever. Talk a little bit about, you know, so much of the focus on season one was on Paul and Allie's relationship, and when you throw in older kids, more complications, what that means for that. Because obviously a couple can go both ways. They can unite and take it on together, or things like this could tear them further apart. What were your sort of thoughts and where Paul and Allie are at this stage and, you know, where their relationship is continuing to grow and change and evolve?
I feel like Paul and Allie have a really solid relationship fundamentally, and they really love each other and make each other laugh, and they're good. But this season, yeah, they are, a lot of things are thrown at them, and they have to keep catching the things that are thrown at them and handling it, which I think they do well. But I feel like through this season, there is a slight separateness between them that, well, obviously it ends that way as well. There's a choice that has to be made where, you know, Ali has to choose sort of to support the son, which they all as the family have to choose, you know, choose to separate and to save their family. So it's about the things that you have to do to keep your family together aren't always the things that will immediately keep your family together. I feel like they go on a real journey in this season, and they have a much harder time as a couple, in a sense, within their relationship, but there's still so much love there, which is what I really love about the writing, because it feels real, you know.
Yeah. And Martin, what was sort of your feeling and how you wanted, where you wanted this relationship to go in the second series?
Well, I think there's just, you know, in any relationship that's been, you know, two people have been together for more than 15 minutes, they experience a bit of everything. And once they're parents, of course, there's no end to, I mean, as long as Paul and Ali are together and as long as they're alive, that there's no end to the stuff that is going to be happening to them and to each other and from the outside world. And as Daisy said, you know, what I like about it is that it's not one-dimensional in that, you know, it's not, you know, an angry man or a nagging woman or, you know, like the good cop, bad cop sort of thing. It's not just that. It's like they both do a bit of everything, you know, and they both really get on. You know, they are friends.
Yeah, they make each other laugh.
Yeah. I think it should just, I wanted it to go, not that it was just my decision, but I was very up for it going in whatever direction that was seen fit, really. I think Simon Blackwell is very, very good at getting to places as a writer where you're taking the audience somewhere that they're not expecting to go, because you might have just been laughing and then you're crying or vice versa, hopefully. But I think he's very good at getting you to invest in these four people. There are more than four people in the show, but the core four people. Some serious stuff happens to everyone, you know, and obviously at the end of season one, some very, very serious stuff happened, like life and death stuff.
Yeah.
And so we try to sort of emulate that, I guess, in series two with something that really, really hooks an audience in, hopefully.
No, absolutely. I don't know if you saw the marketing for the show here in the United States. FX always has these amazing posters. This year, the poster was the two of you, like, wearing your kids as backpacks, like, holding on to them. And I thought it was the perfect sort of imagery for the jump and where the show goes this season.
It was great. Yeah, it was a really good visual idea. Yeah.
Yeah, and it sort of immediately told you where things were going.
Yes.
One of the things that also I always think about as a parent, and it comes up in Breeders, is that line of, you know, when are you friends? And you want to be best friends with your kids, but there is that line, and you sort of, you know, it gets harder to walk that line when your kids get older. And, you know, you can't be their friend, but yet now they're walking, talking human beings, and you want to be their friend even more, but you can't. And I love when, you know, Paul's, you know, talking about, you know, I thought we were mates. I just love whenever, you know, that sort of, you know, question of what is our relationship here? What is our dynamic?
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny.
Throughout all the ages, aren't there? I think. I mean, Daisy's kids in real life are a bit younger than mine, but I think there's always different versions of that. Like, to what extent do you want to be a friend, even to a toddler?
What's the balance? What's the balance? It's a permanent. It's like must be just a. It's a constant thing, isn't it? That you're always trying to get right.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And I'm speaking for myself. I'm always, you know, trying and succeeding sometimes and failing sometimes and not quite. And making mistakes that I know I'm making while I'm making them, and I can't quite stop myself doing it. I suppose it gets more pronounced, I think, as they get into preteens and teens, because they are literally more independent, and they're having more of their own friends and sleepovers and going to parties and stuff like that. So yeah, that really challenges your notion of being a parent. And being in charge, because ultimately you are in charge and you have to be. Someone's got to be in charge, you know. But you're also letting them learn, and you're learning yourself with how much leeway you can give them, aren't you?
Speaking of, so I asked you what people, parents mostly say to you when they watch the show. What about non-parents? People who don't know what it's like to have kids and then they watch Breeders, do you think, have you scared them off from having kids, or...
I had a few messages from people who didn't have kids saying, thank you. I don't feel bad about not having kids now. Thank you for not doing the smug version of parenting, which makes me feel like I'm missing out. Thank you for doing the real version, which makes me think, good for you. But I'm really glad I didn't do that. It's confirmed something. I've had like 3 or 4 people say that to me, which I thought was funny, because it wasn't meant to, you know, put people off children. But I think people that have already made that decision then go, oh, well, that's all the stuff I don't really want to deal with. That's fine.
Yeah. People say that to me, like, that thing of, oh my God, I don't want kids, or, you know, it wasn't designed either as a pro or anti thing, really. But it's not designed to make the population drop, you know. I would hope. I mean, the hope for me is always that, as well as the obvious thing about the show, which is you see adults interacting with children, I think, in a way that is fairly rare in a comedic setting. There is also I hope there's a lot of hugging and kissing and laughter. And I hope it's clear that the Worsley parents love their kids a lot, you know, and the kids love them. But it definitely comes with complications. But it's all born out of love. I mean, there's stuff between Paul and Ali this year that, you know, where Paul is saying, you know, it's out of love, don't you? You know it. And Ali's like, yeah, she does know it. But can't you just go 6 degrees over there, you know,
And no, and you can see it, and that's how you really feel for these characters, especially for the kids this season. So where do we go from here? What is the plan to do any more time jumps for a third season, or where might the Breeders go from here?
I'm not sure, to be honest. No, I'm not sure. I mean, you know, it's just about to come out in the UK now, you know, second series is just about to come out in the UK now. So, we're going to kind of see where it goes. And we certainly hope, we'd like to do more, I think, you know. But yeah. I don't know what that would mean in terms of time jumps or anything like that.
Yeah. And Daisy, you're game for few more visits with the family?
Oh, I'd love to do more. It's just a lovely job. It's, you know, it's a gift to have such good writing and such a lovely actor to work with all the time. And such lovely, just a lovely, you know, vibe on set. So I should be so lucky.
Yeah, I didn't realize that it hadn't come out yet in the UK.
Coming out tonight.
Oh, wow.
As we speak, yeah.
Oh, very, very exciting. Well, congrats on the second season. You know, again, so personal and so, you know, just, you're right. I mean, loving, I think, is a good way to describe it. Like a real, real, like, accurate depiction of you hate your kids 1 second, you love them the next second, hate them again. They hate each other. They hate you. They love you. It's the complicated relationships and emotions of parenting. But I would say it's worth it in the end. And and we can see it on Breeders on FX here in the United States. Martin and Daisy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Season 2 of Breeders is now streaming on FX on Hulu. And that's it for this edition of Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. Drew Griffith edited this episode, and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest Emmy predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Danielle Terciano and Jazz Tanke, I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you on the circuit. For your Emmy Awards consideration, ABC's number one comedy, The Conners, starring John Goodman, Laurie Metcalf, Sarah Gilbert, and Lacey Goranson, about the iconic working-class family who face life with love, humor, and perseverance. The Los Angeles Times describes The Conners as finding laughter and light in the darkness, and Decider writes that the show is what a great sitcom looks like. The Conners, eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series and in all eligible categories. Television Academy members can view full episodes at abcfyc.com.